From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Quincy City Councilors push to block reconstruction of the bridge to Long Island.
There could have been a much better solution to this. This is just, we're going to ram it down your throat, and we don't care. And that's what's going on here.
We'll get the mayor of Quincy's take. Also today, sports with Bill Littlefield. We'll talk Celtics, Bruins, and Red Sox, plus the campaign to pardon legendary boxer Jack Johnson from a century-old conviction by an all-white jury.
No family wants to have shame placed upon them for something that they did not do.
And Star Trek's George Takei. When he was just 5 years old, his family was forced from their California home and into a Japanese internment camp.
I still remember the barbed wire fences that confined me. The tall sentry towers with the machine guns pointed at us.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's begin today with the ongoing dispute between Quincy and Boston over a proposed bridge to Long Island in Boston Harbor. Now, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh officially filed plans last week to rebuild the bridge. It had been abruptly shut down in 2014 because it was unsafe, and that forced the closure of hundreds of beds for the homeless and for addiction treatment that were on Long Island. Boston's Chief of Health and Human Services, Marty Martinez, says the city wants to build a modern new recovery and treatment facility on Long Island, but they have to build the bridge first.
We have a unique opportunity to create a campus that's away from neighborhoods, that's away from some of the challenges that people might face.
But Quincy isn't having it because residents there are concerned about increased traffic that the bridge would bring and the lack of clarity about what Marty Walsh's bigger plans are for Long Island. Well, joining us now on the line is the mayor of Quincy, Thomas Koch. Mayor Koch, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
So first of all, I mean, there was a hearing yesterday in Quincy with residents in the neighborhood. I mean, what did you hear from folks?
Yeah, we had about 300 people out at the Squanum School last night, folks from Squanum and the Marina Bay sections of our city. And it was quite clear that they want no part of a bridge connecting through Quincy because, once again, it brings all the traffic through some residential neighborhoods, particularly Squanum.
Yeah. So, but tell me, what's the difference between this new bridge that Mayor Walsh wants to bring and the old bridge that was once there, right? I mean, before Mayor Menino had to close it down to regular traffic, the bridge was there. So what's the difference this time around?
Well, the difference is the bridge isn't there now. So the people are very happy with the quality of life. There were always issues when the bridge was there. You know, there's a long history of Boston using Moon Island and Long Island for things they don't want in their neighborhoods, and yet they want to continue to put them by our neighborhoods. And it's really an issue of access out there, that the traffic and migrating through that neighborhood is not an easy one. You know, what the city of Boston wants to do with the island is their business. But when the bridge connects to Moon Island, which is in Quincy, It's our business. They'll be using our streets. So I was hoping that the city of Boston would take a closer look at potential water taxi and ferries. We have cities all over the world that live by ferry. In fact, Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard live by ferry, quite frankly.
Yeah. So just to be clear, I just want to be sure I understood what you just said, that the difference is after they closed the bridge down, obviously traffic died down, and the residents prefer it that way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
And before the bridge was built, they operated ferries to that hospital, Long Island Hospital, for decades.
Yeah. So, you know, Boston has been saying, I should make it clear that we did put some requests out to Mayor Marty Walsh and he declined to join us today. But the city has been saying that Quincy would benefit if Boston was able to build this new recovery treatment campus on Long Island. And I just want to play a little bit of tape for you, Mr. Mayor Koch. This is from Chris Osgood. He's the chief of Boston's chief of streets, saying that the city provides services for people from around the region, and that would be true, too, for a new recovery center on Long Island.
This is about a regional challenge. We are working with all of our regional partners, including obviously Quincy, and we think whether it's through the methods of construction or the services that we're going to provide, this is something that we can work with our partners in Quincy on.
Your thoughts?
Well, quite frankly, we are doing our part, not only for Quincy, but for the region as well. City of Quincy is no slouch. We have a homeless shelter. We have a number of facilities in Quincy, detox facilities, sober homes, methadone van. We have an awful lot now for treatment and for people that are going through substance abuse crisis. I think that's laudable to look at a regional approach. And if we're going to go a reasonable regional approach, then maybe there's other sites we look at, too, maybe beyond the bounds of Boston as well. You know, there's communities across the Commonwealth on the South Shore that, do not, in my opinion, don't do their part on some of these issues, and perhaps they could participate in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it really comes down to the access issue. It's not about what's on the island. And, again, I applaud what they're considering to do because we certainly need more of it. But I just think that adding that traffic burden through my residential streets is not the way to do it.
Mm. Well, that's Mayor Thomas Koch. He's mayor of the city of Quincy, speaking to us about the concerns that residents in Quincy have about Mayor Marty Walsh's desire to rebuild or build a new bridge to Long Island. Mayor Koch, thank you so very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Enjoy the day.
And I should say that, once again, we did put a call out to Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, and he was unable to join us today. Well, let's move on to some other news or other stories from around the region. It's no secret that New Hampshire's state-run tax-free liquor stores draw in new customers from across the region, and it's been this way for years. Perhaps maybe you make a quick stop on your way through the state to pick up your favorite libation, tax-free, on the cheap. But for decades, law enforcement from nearby states have been keenly watching these purchases, especially for those folks who are really stocking up. Reporter Todd Bookman has the story of a recent wave of arrests aimed at bootleggers coming into the Granite State.
Right around noon on November 9th of last year, a black Chevy Suburban pulled up to a New Hampshire liquor store. The driver was a guy named Jun Cheng Chen, 46 years old, from Queens, New York. Chen bought some booze, then headed off to another liquor store to make another purchase, then another, then another. In total, he bought liquor at six different New Hampshire stores that afternoon. Chen didn't know it, but he was being watched. A criminal investigator with the New York State Department of Taxation was trailing him, following him from store to store, and then southbound on the highway. When Chen crossed the border back into New York, the investigator contacted a state trooper. Chen was pulled over with 757 liters of alcohol in his trunk, including more than 500 bottles of Hennessy cognac. He was arrested on felony charges for violating New York state law regarding importation of liquor. Ming Li Chen is his attorney.
We happen to have the same last name, but not related.
Ming Li Chen says his client had no previous charges related to bootlegging. He also denies that he was going to resell the liquor.
He was buying the alcohol for personal use, for parties at home or parties somewhere.
500 bottles of Hennessy for personal use, for parties. Okay. Anyways, officials from the Department of Taxation in New York declined to answer questions about this case or any of their activities in New Hampshire. That silence makes it hard to know how frequently they're conducting these types of stings. But what's clear is this. Other states know New Hampshire is a source for alcohol for bootleggers, and they're willing to cross state borders to try to stop it.
You know, from our perspective, this is an organized criminal activity.
Gary Kessler is deputy commissioner at the Vermont Department of Liquor Control. Along with New York, court records show his agency has also sent investigators to stake out New Hampshire liquor store parking lots in recent months, including in Peterborough and Keene. When the customers crossed back into Vermont with trucks full of booze, they were arrested for violating that state's liquor laws.
Clearly, these guys aren't just randomly deciding that they're going to come up and buy some cases of alcohol. They're coming up here with a shopping list. These guys have a notebook. They have the money and the gift cards.
These operations by other states are happening without the assistance or knowledge of New Hampshire officials. The Liquor Commission says it wasn't notified. Neither was the AG's office or state police.
Well, quite frankly, I'm troubled by it.
Cross-border enforcement by these other states comes at an awkward time for the Liquor Commission. Earlier this year, Executive Counselor Andrew Walensky called for an investigation into how the state agency handles large all-cash transactions. Transactions, he says, could be in violation of federal financial laws. The IRS has also been asking questions about bootleggers. Valinsky says the lack of communication between the states raises additional concerns.
I'm troubled that there's not the ability to coordinate with New Hampshire to address these issues. And I think it's a sad state of affairs that we as New Hampshire are not setting an ethical example.
Ethics aside, liquor is big business in New Hampshire. The state-run stores are a cash cow today and have been going back decades. And other states have been angry about their residents making illegal purchases for apparently just as long. Back in the 1970s, Massachusetts and Connecticut sent officials to stake out liquor store parking lots. According to Tom Rath, who was attorney general at the time, this didn't sit well with then-Governor Mel Thompson. Rath says the governor ordered New Hampshire State Police to shoo away the tax collectors.
And it got pretty feisty, and Governor Thompson was never one to back away from an issue like that. So it was an interesting time.
Rath says the big difference between then and now is the size of the purchases. These aren't just folks picking up a few bottles of scotch. These bootleggers are moving huge quantities, and they're likely reselling them.
That's a lot of Hennessy.
Yeah.
I met this gentleman recently in a Manchester liquor store parking lot.
Believe on that about that bootlegger that's been going on for 50 years.
He wasn't eager to give his name. He also wasn't excited about the attention bootlegging is getting from law enforcement right now. But he doesn't expect it to stop.
I'm going to tell you something. This is going to be a story, a hot story for a minute, and that's it.
And with that, he continued loading case after case of Hennessy cognac into his white van with New York plates.
That story from reporter Todd Bookman comes to us through the New England News Collaborative. It's going to last longer than a hot minute. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Since 1966, George Takei has been known the world over for his role as Hikaru Sulu, helmsman of the NCC 1701, better known as the Enterprise on Star Trek. But just little more than 20 years before Takei's television fame, he and his family, simply by virtue of their ancestry, had been viewed as enemies of the United States. George Takei was one of the more than 127,000 Japanese Americans imprisoned in internment camps during World War II. In 2012, Takei put his story on stage. The musical Allegiance is based on his family's experiences in the internment camps, and Allegiance is making its New England premiere at Boston Speakeasy Stage Company, and George Takei joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much.
It's such a pleasure to have you. First of all, let me just start by hearing more about your experiences in the camps. You were 5 years old?
I was 5 years old when I just turned five, just a few weeks after my fifth birthday, when soldiers came marching up our driveway, stomped up the front porch, with their fists began pounding on the front door. And my brother and I happened to be in the living room, and we were terrified. My father, who was packing back in the bedroom, came out, answered the door, and literally at gunpoint, we were ordered out of our home. My father gave my brother and me little pieces of luggage to carry, and we followed him out onto the driveway and waited for our mother to come out. And when she finally emerged, she had our baby sister in one arm and a huge duffel bag in the other, and tears were streaming down her cheeks. That was a long time ago for me, but I will never be able to forget that terrifying morning.
And you eventually, not immediately, but eventually were sent to one of the internment camps in Arkansas.
That's right.
Okay.
We were taken from our home to the horse stables of Santa Anita Racetrack. And from a two-bedroom home on Garnet Street, we were assigned one horse stall, still pungent with the smell of horse manure. And that was to be our home for about 3 months while the camps were being built. And then, when the construction was completed, we were put on trains with armed guards at both ends of each car and taken two-thirds of the way across the country to the swamps of southeastern Arkansas.
And this was the, I hope I'm saying it correctly, the Rower War Relocation Center, a wonderful Orwellian name there. and so you were five. What was life in the camp like?
Well, on the way there, I remember asking my father, where are we going? And it took him a while. He had to think a little bit, but he said, we're going on a long vacation to a place called Arkansas. Arkansas? That sounded exotic to me. We were going on a vacation to Arkansas. It could have been Hawaii. It had the same exotic sound. And for me, actually, it was a fun experience, catching pollywogs in the clear water of the bayou there and watching them spring legs and turn into frogs, catching butterflies. And, you know, we heard that particularly at twilight, strange sounds coming from beyond the barbed wire fence. It was a forest, but I called it the jungle. And, you know, there were the cawing sounds and the hooting sounds and chirping sounds. And I told my brother, there were dinosaurs out there in the jungle, and the barbed wire fence was to keep the dinosaurs out.
So that's the innocence of childhood in the midst of imprisonment for nothing more than ancestry.
Children are amazingly adaptable. You know, what would have been grotesquely abnormal became normality in our lives. It became routine for me to line up three times a day in to eat a lousy food in a noisy mess hall. It became normal for me to go with my father and brother to bathe in a mass shower. And it became normal for me to go to school in a black tar paper barrack and begin the school day with the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I could see the barbed wire fence and the sentry towers right outside my schoolhouse window as I recited the words, with liberty and justice for all. An innocent kid, totally oblivious of the stinging irony in those words.
How much later did that horrific irony settle on you?
Well,
I mean, how old were you when it finally dawned on you that your nation had treated you as an enemy of the state, essentially?
Well, as a teenager, I became very curious about what I was beginning to learn about my childhood. And so I became a voracious reader. I read all the history books that I could get my hands on. Couldn't find anything about my childhood imprisonment. I read civics books, and I read about the high ideals of American democracy. All men are created equal, endowed with an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I couldn't relate that to what I knew to be my childhood imprisonment. The only person I could go to was my father.
Yeah.
And I had many long, sometimes heated after-dinner conversations with my father about our internment.
Heated? Why?
I knew about the ideals, you know, what democracy is supposed to be. And I said, Daddy, I would have organized my friends at school and gone downtown to the federal building and demonstrated. And he said, well, I suspect you would have done that. But I had to think about your mother, you, your brother, and sister. They were pointing guns at me.
Mm-hmm.
If something happened to me, what do you think would happen to you guys? And I understood, but I kept saying, but Daddy, it was wrong. It's against the Constitution. It was, you should have protested it. I mean, there's no one more arrogant than an idealistic teenager. I gave my father a hard time. And some of the things I said, I regret to this day.
Yeah.
And back then, I didn't apologize for it. And one of the great regrets I have is that I never apologized to the man that I love so much, who bore the awful burden of the pain and the anxiety and the loss and the humiliation and the rage of all that happened, wave after wave of goading insults and deprivation. And this arrogant teenager gave him a hard time.
Your father, he didn't even live long enough to hear his nation apologize to him, right?
That's
because
right.
President Ronald Reagan in 1988, almost 50 years later, finally, on behalf of the United States, apologized to the citizens who had been interned.
That's correct. He died in 1979, never to know that there would be an apology.
So I've read that you have said that this musical, Allegiance, in part is your apology to your father.
The last scene in Allegiance, where a very aged Sam Kimura, the character I play, apologizes again after his father is gone to his memory of his father. And so every night when I perform that scene, I am apologizing to my father for all that arrogant teenager put him through. But I am not in the Boston production.
Yeah, I was just going to say. I don't want to mislead folks.
Yes. And that's why I'm so excited to be here, because for the first time, I will be able to see Allegiance. I've been in it since 2012, and I've never seen Allegiance.
The roles that you play are being played by, I have it here, I have the
a guy named
Gary Ng. Yeah. And the young Sammy Kumura is being played by Sam Tanabe.
Yes.
So it's
and
a great cast.
He was with us in the Broadway production.
Yeah. So, I mean, we could talk for hours, and unfortunately I do not have hours, there's so many tragedies about the internment of Japanese Americans. I mean, there's the loyalty oath that citizens were asked to sign, and your family was moved to another internment camp in California on the California-Oregon border. But I'm dying to ask you the following question, so forgive me if I follow all over myself, because yes, I am sitting across from Mr. Sulu. I will admit, I am a fan. But in 1966, when you were one of the starring roles in Star Trek, the 1966 version of Star Trek, one of its great draws and breakthroughs was that it was Gene Roddenberry's vision of equality and diversity put on television.
In the future.
In the
23rd
future.
23rd century.
But, I mean, just 22 years before that, you had been interned by the U.S. government. I mean, did people on the set know that? Did anyone at Star Trek know?
Okay. They knew. Okay. In between scenes, we chit-chat. You know, you run out of things to talk about, and people talk about their childhood, and I shared some of my childhood memories with them, and they were initially aghast. They had never heard of American citizens of Japanese ancestry being incarcerated. So we chatted about that just casually, set aside conversation.
I mean, how did Leonard Nimoy react to that?
Oh, Leonard was incensed, and he was really outraged that our democracy did something like that. As were many of the others, Walter Koenig, a Jewish American whose parents fled Russia because of the pogroms. Mm-hmm. And Nichelle Nichols, of course, you know, being an African American,
right,
understood the kind of racism that would happen after an event like Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
We were seen as an enemy. At 5 years old, I was classified as enemy alien. I was neither. I was, you know, a kid. How could I be an enemy? And I was born and raised in Los Angeles. My mother was born and raised in Sacramento, California. My father was born in Japan, but brought to San Francisco as a boy, and he was reared and educated in San Francisco, and he called himself a San Franciscan all his life. I said, Daddy, you spent more of your life in Los Angeles. Why do you call yourself a San Franciscan? He said, once a San Franciscan, always a San Franciscan. We were Americans.
Yeah.
And yet, because of our faces, we were considered enemy aliens.
I mean, so I wanted to ask you about the irony of then being on Star Trek in this sort of play-acted utopia,
mm-hmm,
of diversity. And also, maybe layered upon that irony, it was 1966, so America still, well, to this day, it's still grappling with issues of civil rights. And we're still, what, 22 years away from President Reagan officially apologizing? I mean, did it ever seem, you were a working actor then, a young working actor, but did it ever seem strange to you that the place that you were able to, one of the places you were able to find complete acceptance was on a starship in the fictional future?
Well, you know, in junior high school, well, my father told us about, you know, our democracy being a participatory democracy. And he urged us to be active in our society. And he offered to buy these cardboard campaign boards, you know, when I was in school. And he said, why don't you support your friend Bobby Thompson for athletic commissioner? And I did. And then the next semester he would say, why don't you get Bobby to support you for health commissioner? And I was eventually voted student body president. So, you know, from the time that I was a teenager, my father was kind of pulling the strings, but I thought it was me that was doing it, you know, and I loved being popular, and I was elected student body president. I thought it was a great thing. And at the end of that semester, the outstanding senior would be given an award called the American Legion Award. And when I told my father that I was a candidate for the American Legion Award, he told me something about the American Legion. Right after Pearl Harbor, the American Legion was one of the fiercest, vociferous advocate for Lock Up the Japs movement. And He was so moved by the fact that I would be nominated to be a candidate for the American Legion Award, the highest award a senior can get. And I wound up receiving that honor. And so I guess for my father it was a lot of mixed feelings,
yeah,
pride and some kind of remembered pain. And the irony of American democracy. And so just, you know, less than a decade after imprisonment, things like that were happening. Things were changing. But it was because my father urged all of us, my brother and my sister, to be actively involved.
Yeah. We've just got 30 seconds to go, George Takei. When people come to see the Speakeasy Stage Company's production, I mean, why do you think it's important for people to see Allegiance now?
People may know about the internment intellectually, but as a drama, that humanizes the story. And with music, which has the power of hitting people deep within their heart, is a powerful way of getting people to identify with us as human beings. Mm. And we hear the sniffles and some sobs. And, of course, at the end, when we come out for our curtain call, it's that spontaneous standing ovation. We're reaching people not just intellectually, but through the heart.
Well, George Takei, actor and activist, and yes, Mr. Sulu as well. The musical Allegiance is playing now at the Speakeasy Stage Company in Boston. We have more information about that at radioboston.org. George Takei, thank you so very much.
And as we say on Star Trek, live long and prosper.
This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I hope that along with listening to this terrific show every day, you also take some time to download and listen to Modern Love, the podcast. It's from the great people here at WBUR and our friends at the New York Times, and I happen to host that podcast as well. So today, we want to share an excerpt from a recent episode of the podcast with you. It's written by Nina Riggs. She was facing the truly unimaginable and found that sometimes the only option was to concentrate on the things she could control and buy online. Riggs' Modern Love essay is When a Couch is More Than a Couch, and it's read by Academy Award-winning actor Kate Winslet.
Were I healthy enough these days, I would be sipping a glass of free wine and running my hands over an exquisite accent pillow in an impossibly hip showroom called something like Space or Lust, while a sales assistant speaks to me of the virtues of aniline versus semi-aniline leather. So you really think kiln-dried hardwood is worth the extra expense, I'd be asking? And does this come in a three-seater? Instead, I'm propped in bed on a dozen pillows with my laptop, perusing online furniture stores. West Elm, Joybird, Crate & Barrel, and something called Chair-ish. I am an internet sofa shopping fiend. I take breaks only when the oxy overwhelms me and my head starts to loll. I cannot rest until I have considered every mid-century modern with a hint of bohemian sofa the World Wide Web has to offer. I pore over design sites like Apartment Therapy, Design Sponge, and Domino, searching, searching. Since John and I married 16 years ago, we have never had a real grown-up couch. We have plenty of well-loved misfits, as is IKEA specials, parental handoffs, Craigslist semi-miracles, and roadside rescues. First we were broke, and then we had babies. It never seemed like the right time to splurge on anything nice. And the misfits have been fine. We're not fancy, and our taste is eclectic. Our house is full of objects that are stronger on personality than looks. The wood box my father and uncle sat on as children to lace their boots for sledding, a lumpy chaise by the front window in the world's coziest reading nook. Anyway, when we have needed to get down to the serious business of life, we have always preferred to retreat to our bed, our war room, cocoon, escape hatch, and at times, dining room. But in the weeks after I learned that the breast cancer I have been in treatment for over the past year had spread to my bones, breaking my spine and becoming incurable and most likely fatal, finding the perfect living room couch has begun to feel like the most important thing I've ever done. Except just when I find one I love, it turns out I can't click buy now. And commitment issues have not generally been my problem. Houses, cars, job switching, kid having, plane ticket buying, restaurant choosing, shoe shopping, mastectomy, bring it. Usually, I just pick a good-seeming option and don't look back. Within 10 minutes of meeting John at a summer job at 21, I had already mentally signed on for life, although I waited at least a week to tell him that. But the couch, I can't do it. Maybe I'm holding off until after my next big oncology appointment, as though something my doctor may say will help determine whether I am willing to spend the extra money for Dacron bedding and poly-down cushions. She promised some new thoughts about treatment options, immunotherapy, clinical trials, off-label drugs, acupuncture, the dreaded watchful waiting. It's a complicated calculus. On the one hand, a basic cost-benefit analysis. How much money do I want to spend on something I may not be around to really enjoy? On the other, isn't buying an expensive couch a kind of lovely expression of hopefulness? And after I'm gone, don't I still want my guests in my home to feel comfortable and stylish? None of this was supposed to happen. At 38, I wasn't supposed to lie on my back in the ER on a late December morning and be told by a teary radiation oncology resident that the pain I'd been having for 2 months, that I'd been assured was from having a weak core after months of chemo, was actually from a tumor that had devoured my L2 vertebra. John wasn't supposed to have to hold me up on the toilet, put my pants on for me, do Christmas Eve for the children without me. I'm not supposed to be thinking about where he will sit and hold my hand as I take my last breath. Despite all the pamphlets the social workers gave us when I was in the hospital, we don't really know how to talk to our boys yet. They are 6 and 9. They know about the cancer and the back break, but they don't really know what it all means. Instead, I ask the 6-year-old, "What do you think of leather upholstery?" "Depends if it's slippery or nuzzly," he says. "Excellent point. I think I need to take any bonded leather options, no matter how cute or economical they seem, off my favorites list and go with the top grain." The day after the emergency surgery, when my doctor was sitting on the end of my bed in the oncology ward, I saw her glance toward those pamphlets that had been left on the bedside table. "What to tell your children about your progressive disease." She's a mother, too. Her children are only a couple of years older than mine. "Is it time to despair?" she said during a pause in our discussion about pain management and radiation, maybe reading one of the pamphlet headings. "No," she proclaimed, staring straight at me. "No, it is not." I trust her completely. Even after the chemo failed twice and the cancer spread when she said it wouldn't, whatever it is in oncologists that makes them want to be oncologists, that crazy mix of fierceness, optimism, arrogance, and compassion, I get a contact high from it. It's like love at first sight or touching something on fire. It's like making a choice and refusing to look back. John is mildly new couch averse, but he's treading carefully. He knows me well enough to understand that when I'm dissertating on the merits of tufted cushions, I'm chewing on something else. "Custom upholstery? Really? With two boys?" he asks, flipping through insurance statements on the counter. "Okay, well, I think you should get whatever you're into." One big upside of being told I have incurable cancer is that after all these years, my husband has finally stopped smugly saying, "It's your funeral," when I make a decision he doesn't agree with. "Did you spend thousands of dollars on the internet today?" he asks when he gets home from work and finds me with my pillows and hot water bottles on the not-perfect couch where he left me in the morning, a low-slung rattan situation my parents bought as patio furniture in the early 90s. "Not today," I say. "Nice," he says. "Do you want to go get in bed together and stare at the ceiling?" "I do." We do. In January, the afternoon already looks like evening. "Can you believe we found out you have incurable cancer on literally the darkest day of the year?" John asks as we hold hands and stare up toward the same blank spot above our bed. "Yeah, I totally can," I say. We both laugh. I have always loved the sound of him laughing. Soft and comfortable, understated, offbeat, with unmistakably sleek mid-century lines. He takes me gingerly in his arms, as if we are awkward teenagers. My back spasms, But I wiggle closer to him until I can put my head on his chest and hear his heart beating. Downstairs, the boys gaze at a screen on the old futon in the playroom. We will figure out what to do about them soon enough. They probably already know what's up and are waiting for us to figure out how to say it. Despite not being much of a Christmas person myself, I hated not being able to watch them open presents and can't bear the thought of never doing it again. Their very existence is the one dark piece I cannot get right within all this. I can let go of a lot of things. Plans, friends, career goals, places in the world I want to see, maybe even the love of my life, but I cannot figure out how to let go of mothering them. So maybe I don't try to figure it out. Maybe I just aim to get the couch right. Strong bones, high quality leather, something earthy and animal and real. A surface that knows something of what it was to be alive, that warms to our touch and cools in our absence. Also, an expansive bench that fits all of us. Something that will hold us through everything that lies ahead. The loving, collapsing, and nuzzling. The dying. The grieving. I know my thoughts have probably diverged from whatever John is thinking about in the near dark of our bedroom. He is silent. Maybe he's dozing. As I lie here, with John's chest rising and falling under my cheek, I realize that my careful calculations, how long do I have left? Who am I really buying this couch for? Am I getting a good deal? Are irrelevant. As in all things, I have to believe I'll know what's right when I see it.
That's Kate Winslet reading Nina Riggs' modern love essay, When a Couch is More Than a Couch. Well, I hope you enjoyed this taste of modern love, the podcast. And if you did, I hope you will subscribe to it. Plus, pick up the Radio Boston podcast as well. It's time to talk sports. And with me in studio is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hello there, Bill.
Hi, Magna.
Okay, so let's start with basketball because the Celts are playing the 76ers tonight, and if they win, they advance to the Eastern Conference Finals. And they've got a bit of a pad here, right? 3-1 over the 76ers already?
Yeah, but you never want to think of it that way. Oh. I mean, it's sitting up there, you know, like a great big fat pitch. Hit it this time. Don't wait. don't wait till it's 3-2 or 3-3.
Okay, fair enough. Now, they were on a winning streak until they, well, to your point, until they lost on Monday, right?
Right.
103-92. Here's head coach Brad Stevens at a press conference afterwards talking about the Sixers.
I thought they were very physical. I thought they were very tough. They crushed us on the glass. We didn't obviously run great offense with the turnovers and everything else. So that run was inevitable if we didn't change how we were playing.
I mean, so was that an off day for the Celts, or was it really Sixers? Right?
I think it's very interesting that he said that run was inevitable. The 76ers have had a very good season. They had a stretch at the end of the regular season where they looked unbeatable. They were, in fact, unbeatable. And so you couldn't really understand how they could play as badly as they did at the ends of the games, the three games that the Celtics won at the beginning of this series. They threw the ball away. They lost track of the clock. They took absolutely hideous shots. They looked like they could have won a couple of those games, and they simply kind of undermined their own best efforts. I think I, at the risk of jinxing the Celtics tonight, I'm going to go with the Celtics. I think some of the Sixers in the fourth game, the game that the Sixers won, some of them had the game of their lives. I think the Celtics match up pretty well against them. I think Brad Stevens is a terrific coach. He's going to understand absolutely what happened in game four, and they'll be all right.
Okay, so you're calling it for the Celts, but also saying better get it over with.
Yeah, this okay. is a good team. I mean, if you let them off the mat, you know.
You never know.
Exactly.
All right, so let's just talk for a second before we move on to other things entirely. Let's talk about the Bruins because it was a weekend of disappointment for hockey fans. They're out of the playoffs, losing to Tampa Bay on Friday and again on Saturday. Final score of that game, 3-1. So what really sealed their fate?
I think part of what sealed their fate was the sense that they were going to continue to play as well as they have at some points this season, and they kind of forgot that they had to really work hard not to play as badly as they have at some points this season. It's been a kind of an inconsistent run. There are a lot of people who think maybe they need to have a goalkeeper who's a little more consistent than Tuukka Rask. I don't want to go too deep into that controversy because fists will fly and people are pretty passionate on both sides of that one. I think they need a little better defense. But to be honest, I haven't paid as much attention to the Bruins as I should be because all of my hockey attention has been on the Vegas Golden Knights, who show every possibility of winning the Stanley Cup in their very first season of existence.
Wow.
An expansion team winning the Stanley Cup. It would be like the 1962 Mets winning the World Series. And they were arguably the worst team ever in baseball. So, I mean, this is just an incredible story. And it's gotten more astonishing with each step that the Vegas Golden Knights have taken.
Wow. Okay. Well, maybe we'll talk to you about that
If they keep it up, everybody will be talking about it.
All right. So I want to turn to something completely different here. It's a kind of a social media story, but really a history story, and it has to do with Jack Johnson. Now, for folks who don't recognize that name, he was the first African-American heavyweight boxing champion back in 1908.
Mm-hmm.
And just a couple of years after that, though, he was convicted by an all-white jury for transporting a white woman who was his girlfriend across state lines for, quote, in the language of 1908, immoral purposes. Well, now there's been this years-long campaign to clear Johnson's name. It's being led by his great-great-niece, Linda Haywood. And she was asked in an interview in 2016 what difference a pardon for her ancestor would make decades after his death. And here's what she said.
I'll tell you, it makes a difference because that's my family member. That's my great-great-uncle, my maternal great-great-uncle, and it matters to us because we are his family, and no family wants to have shame placed upon them for something that they did not do.
Now, the social media part in here comes because President Donald Trump tweeted last month that he is considering a full pardon for Jack Johnson. He hasn't said anything about it since, but your take, Bill.
He didn't say, if you forget what Mr. Cohen did on my behalf, I promise to pardon Jack Johnson, something like that. This would be a case of Donald Trump doing the right thing. Jack Johnson was a victim of fierce, violent prejudice of his time. He probably never would have been arrested if he hadn't been heavyweight champion. There were many, many people who felt that it was completely inappropriate to have a black man be the heavyweight champion of the world. Many great black fighters of that time were prevented from fighting for a title because they were black. And Johnson was cheerfully exuberant about his whole life. He drove big cars. He made a lot of noise. He ate big. He lived big. And he was proud to do it. And he really made a lot of white folks angry. And I think that's the story of why he got eventually sent to prison. He ran off, left the country.
He had to flee. He fled the country.
He was convicted, but eventually did serve time. And there's no question. He was a victim of hideous racial prejudice. And if Trump pardons him, good on Trump.
Yeah. I mean, there have only, as far as we can count, only two posthumous pardons have ever been granted by presidents. And as I said before, the President Trump did tweet this, but he hasn't said anything since. So we shall see. I've got the tweet here. It says, this is from the president on April 21st. He says, Sylvester Stallone.
Ruins it. He never would have heard of Jack Johnson if Sylvester Stallone hadn't called him. His old pal Sly called him, and then they're off to the races.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe Mr. Stallone, call him up again.
Let's see what happens.
We just got a minute left here, Bill. And let's talk about the Sox. They're facing the Yankees this week. The Sox lost yesterday, 3-2. They've got a chance at redemption tonight and tomorrow. Your quick take there.
Well, I don't know about redemption, but I will say that I'm a believer in the old baseball cliche, which is momentum is tomorrow's starting pitcher. In this case, tonight's starting pitcher, the Sox have Porcello going. He's been extraordinarily successful, won five games already this season. And The Tanaka's pitching for the Yankees. He's 4-2. I say Porcello has pretty good chance of achieving something for the Red Sox, although, as I say, redemption seems to me a reach.
Okay. Well, if you can use the sports cliche about momentum being the next pitcher, I can say redemption.
You can say whatever you like. Well, you're the host.
Bill Littlefield, thank you for reminding me, is host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs right here on WBUR every Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Bill, thank you as always.
Thank you, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.